So what's so interesting about zinc is it's one of the most important, you can sort of simply summarize and say, it's like a birth control for viruses, right? If you've got a viral insult in the body, zinc is part of your team of resources that can slow down viral replication and can help your body conquer, tackle, and kind of shut that virus down from moving cell to cell and taking over its host. So if you've got the infection on board, your zinc volume, your zinc load that you have, your body naturally is going to gobble it up, use it up as a part of its natural defense mechanism. And if you deplete your zinc levels so far that they become depleted, that you can't smell and you can't taste, it's like this big red meter to say, wow, your body's working really, really hard to fight this off.
Welcome back to the Reinvent Health Podcast. I'm Nikki Robertson, and today we're diving into a topic that is affecting millions of people worldwide: long-haul COVID and mycotoxin-triggered illness. While many recover from the virus within weeks, others are left grappling with lingering symptoms that disrupt their daily lives, often without clear answers or solutions. To help us understand the science, challenges, and potential paths to recovery, I'm joined by Dr. Christy Moreland-Hughes, a leading expert in functional medicine and the creator of a program designed to help people regain their health and resilience after chronic illness. Today, we'll explore the connection between immune and metabolic health and practical steps to support healing. If you or someone you know has been struggling with exhaustion, dizziness, persistent head and body aches, brain fog, and fatigue, this episode is packed with valuable information. You can find out more about Dr. Christy and how to contact her in the show notes. Let's get started. So for our audience, let's dive into firstly a little bit about who you are and your background, which is extensive, and then what brought you to this topic of mycotoxins and long-haul COVID and these mysterious symptoms that people, so many people have, but don't know how to fix because those people we trust to help us have no idea either. So let's start with who you are.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I love our long-standing history, so you know me well enough to know that, you know, my focus was always food, nutrition, nutrigenomics, epigenetics, personalized medicine. And, you know, I was living it. And I feel like if I look back and reflect up until 2020, you know, I was really at the peak of my health. You know, I was 49 years old and I was like lifting weights higher than I had. I was lean. I was healthy. You know, like I was absolutely at my optimal. And then I got hit with spike protein injury and I had no idea what it really meant or what it would look like. So for me, you know, if I hadn't lived it from the inside out, I wouldn't understand what long hauling is. I wouldn't understand what this post-viral syndrome happened to be. And unfortunately, the deep dive down into figuring out what happened to me revealed as I sort of came up to the surface, we never really knew that this particular virus, SARS-CoV-2, and its multiple variants would reactivate, could reactivate old infections that were dormant and not bothering people. You know, this is kind of the modern version, or the Dr. Jeff Bland and I have had many conversations about this, and he helped me reframe it that this is just the new version of what we learned about Epstein-Barr converting into, again, mono, right? Mono, Epstein-Barr becoming chronic fatigue syndrome, and people with tick-borne disease ending up, you know, getting bit by a tick, getting sick, getting well, or converting on into those multiple system immune deficiency syndromes, or again, Gulf War syndrome and certain vaccine triggers and infections that cause Gulf War syndrome, right? These are all examples of what really is recognized as post-viral fatigue syndromes.
Okay.
And that's really what long haul is. It's just, it's a new virus. It's a new way. But what really makes this round novel is that this bizarre virus actually has two main mechanisms that it challenges: the immune system and the cardiovascular system. And so we have a whole different understanding at this point, kind of looking back in hindsight, it's a little bit easier to recognize, but spike protein attaches to the ACE2 receptor sites. And that's one of the ways it gains access to your cell. It works its way into that cell or into the tissue. And oddly, I kind of like it, Jeff Bland framed it this way for me, so it kind of helped, sort of turns those cells into zombie cells. in which it decapacitates the capacity of that cell to make cellular energy, right? We can see the pathophysiology now where, in light of that viral insult and the activation of spike protein, for many, it resulted in a severe mitochondrial deficiency in which the cell is barely hanging on. It's no longer functioning, but the virus has hijacked it for its own sustainability. Right, we get hypoxia. I mean, that's just sort of the beginning of the story. So I think the two drivers, massive drivers of what we would call is a second epidemic, right? This is the second post-pandemic epidemic of post-viral syndrome. One is the damage to these ACE2 receptors, right? And two is the challenge with viral persistence, right? And so those are really the two factors that lead to this whole downstream trickle-down effect, which all of us in functional medicine, integrative care, and nutrition, we've already been dealing with those things. And we're talking about multiple infections, right? Or we're talking about the mitochondrial challenges. We're talking about the gut microbiome complications and the autoimmune, right? Or the molecular mimicry, right? They can happen. So, what's so unique about this virus? It's not like other forms of previous strains of SARS-CoV. It's not the same thing. It impacts our vasculature, and we have 60,000 miles of blood vessels, 100,000 kilometers. For your listeners, right? And you think about that, we've always, in medicine, thought about the ACE2 receptor as it relates back to hypertension. Like that's kind of been the big story. But this is a virus that causes vessel vascular damage. And for so many of us, what set us up for those susceptibilities had nothing to do with whether or not we had a healthy lifestyle, if we ate the right foods, if we exercised, if we were mindful. I mean, the second wave that we really do see as the second epidemic right now, they're really healthy people. They're young people, and they're people who are ending up with hypoxia and exercise reduction or athletic performance challenges and, kind of coming on really strong and really impactfully somewhere for most people around 2 to 3 months after their exposure to spike protein.
So what we are seeing here is a resurgence or people getting re-diagnosed with COVID-19 all over again. And is it COVID-19 or is it just the, like you say, the tail end and the damage from 5 years ago that hasn't left the system?
Yeah, I think we're looking at kind of a combination of both. So you get exposed, you could get sick, you can expose and not really have symptoms. I think that's the really challenging thing that we've learned about this current wave. Some people got really, really acutely ill. Others didn't even know they were exposed to COVID because they didn't express any symptoms. And then all of a sudden, 2 to 3 months after the exposure, now they have fatigue, they have brain fog. They have exhaustion. Some, it ends up in the gut because of the ACE2 receptors. For some, it's the cardiovascular system. For others, it's their joints. It's arthralgia. There's common denominators that we are seeing. I mean, I think it's wild that we now have 200 documented symptoms that belong to the COVID post-COVID syndrome, right? But there's kind of like a dozen that show up in almost everybody. And it's this unexplainable fatigue. Right. It's these complications with immune and inflammatory regulation. It's often sleep dysfunction and not feeling quenched when you wake up in the morning. One interesting one I just hear over and over in my athlete market is those who they've been athletic, even pro athletes, right? Who are used to their training routine, they're used to pushing themselves and cycling their athletic capability. All of a sudden, they can't do that lift anymore. Or they can't get through that Pilates class. Or in my non-athletes, it's these patients who are like, I don't know what happened, but I can't walk all the way out to the mailbox and all the way back to my house, like huffing and puffing with shortness of breath, and I'm exhausted. And that's what we're seeing in the entire spectrum of all ages right now. Fatigue, various different levels of fatigue syndromes.
And I, you've described almost everybody I come in contact with every single day. These symptoms, everyone without exception, and people who they just don't seem to be unhealthy. They're looking after themselves, they're eating well, they're training. And almost everyone that I come across complains of chronic fatigue, brain fog, unexpected pain, They can't get answers. They're doing everything right, but something's wrong. So, before we look at what we're going to do, but you mentioned that this is what you've been tackling for the last, goodness, 2 years you've
Three
been
years,
battling, 3 years you've been battling with
three
this.
years, like to the point where I thought I was going to die. And
Oh.
I was writing like letters to my kids, and all my kids now have these plastic buckets with everything I ever collected around the world for them, which I call them the when I die buckets.
Oh my God.
And like, I thought that they would inherit them when I'm 80, you know? And I was like, oh my gosh, I got to finish my when I'm dead buckets.
Oh
Because, like, what if they didn't know I got this in Cape Town and I got this in London and this was from your grandma and this was from your great grandma? Like, that was like the level of how sick I was. And I remember this moment, you know, like on your phone when you forget your password or you have to log into
yeah.
something and then you say, like, right, ping, send me the code, right? And then you usually get like a six-digit code that shows up.
Yeah.
When I knew how bad my brain fog was, I could not remember the six-digit code enough to switch from one screen to the next. And I'd be like, are you kidding me? How can I not remember six numbers? And I'd try like a little rhythm pattern in my head to try to make it sing-song. And I still couldn't remember the six-digit code to get from one screen to the next. Those were like the little things, right? For me, where I was like, oh my gosh, this is way worse than I even think it is,
Yeah.
right? And so those little mile markers, right? When you're getting better, the day that I converted my first six-digit code and I realized that I didn't have to write it down or go flip back and forth twice, I was like, okay, now I'm getting my brain back.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go into what it took to, get down that healing path, because I'm pretty sure a lot of people listening will go, "Wow, that's me, and I thought I was getting early onset dementia. Meanwhile, maybe it's something else, because this is what we think."
Yeah, it is. I think ultimately when somebody described to me that long hauling, or proper term too, is post-acute sequelae COVID. So it's called PASC, PASC, right? We sometimes call it long haul. We may call it post-viral fatigue syndrome. They're kind of the sort of three terms being sort of thrown around right now. But I think what is like such an interesting piece, a kind of tracking and following that is, it's also like hypoxia that can come with high altitude sickness, right? We have this damage to the blood vessels, right? The spike protein, vascular challenge for many, which could be because of their genetic susceptibility and their susceptibility to inflammation, right? And so all of a sudden, we've got blood vessels that are challenged, that are struggling. We've got microclotting in some individuals, right? And remember in the beginning, the first wave where people had purple fingers, blue toes, blue purple lips,
That's right.
right? That's hypoxia, right? Like if you ascended up to like 14,000 foot on a mountain and you immediately induced a high altitude sickness, right? You're gasping for oxygen. We had hypoxic changes throughout all the tissues. So when it's your brain, you can't think and you can have a headache and you can have inflammation. When it's the lungs, we're coughing and coughing and coughing as this attempt to try to move oxygen in and out of our vasculature. Not that there's an infection in the pulmonary tubes, right? When it's the joints, we're stiff, we're sore. Right. When we're looking at the GI tract, people are getting gut pain, diarrhea, instabilities in their bowel regularity. Right. And then one of the, I think, really huge emerging pieces of the story is that viruses can hit and impact the vagus nerve. Right. And that vagus nerve runs, that cranial 10 runs out of the base of our skull. It innervates all of our swallowing mechanisms and our voice, our diaphragm, our digestion or bowel motility. And like the thing that blew me away, and you know me and my history, I can stand on a stage and talk for 10 hours and I like it. I could hardly, like, I could hardly get my voice out. My larynx was hoarse and whispery. And it was this side of my neck, it was this side of my vagus nerve that got hit for some reason. I couldn't swallow for 2 years. I was like choking on my saliva. I couldn't eat meat. I'm not a vegetarian, and it gets pretty old doing smoothies and soft food all the time. And it's just so fascinating to be able to look at the complications of the gut-brain connection that come through this vagus nerve challenge that is kind of another big piece of the puzzle. So what was the big aha for me? Like the big aha for me is that when exposed to spike protein, there's this interesting little dance, almost like a lock and key. There's this little family of viruses and sort of bugs that operate interestingly and now kind of in coercion with each other. And if you have a history of Epstein-Barr, maybe getting mono when you were a kiddo, if you have herpes simplex virus dormant in your system, if you have HHV6, these were like the three main viruses that if you had them before, they can get reactivated when you meet COVID, the various different variants. So for many people, their old chronic fatigue symptoms or their old herpes simplex symptoms, we saw also a challenge in patients who maybe had tick-borne disease and a previous exposure to Lyme or one of the co-infections.
Breaks it
So I
up.
think those stuff, yeah, those they get woken up, right? Like these stealth dormant infections that you and your body were living symbiotically with, were non-activated and not an issue, now got re-triggered and reactivated and rose to the surface. So that's my story.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. As you're speaking, I can think of 10 people that I see, on and off every month who are saying exactly this, that old viruses that they've forgotten about have resurged, coughs that won't go away, just niggles that are pervasive and they cannot come to terms with why these things are just all over. What does this sort of post-viral fatigue, neuroinflammation, post-COVID syndrome have to do with mold illness? Where are the correlations with mold illness?
Well, what we're certainly seeing is that many people are around mold. I mean, it's everywhere, like it's pretty hard to be in a building or in a community or a space that hasn't had mold. I mean, there's some reports that say up to 50% of buildings, schools, workplaces have some level of mold, active mold, water damage, or mycotoxin output, right? And so what's interesting, and I didn't get mold until now. I didn't understand the mycotoxin, biotoxin illness story until now. And so, what's really fascinating, kind of just stepping back and talking about why mold-related illnesses. Okay, so SIRS, chronic inflammatory response syndrome, SIRS is the proper term for those who have the susceptibility to being around mold, in which it triggers a chronic inflammatory response pattern in their body, which can then downstream trigger hypersensitivities, metabolic dysregulation, histamine disorders, MCAS challenges, POTS, dysautonomia, right? Fatigue syndrome, exhaustion, right? It's a kind of a specific list that you use in screening for SIRS, which kind of helps you tease apart the long haul piece and kind of get a little bit of a clarity. Well, maybe there's also a mold underlying story that got triggered or woken up with the exposure to spike protein, right? So mold, one of the interesting things, and I didn't really grok this before, like I kind of had heard it in passing, but I didn't really get it. But the statistics are around 24% of the population doesn't have the ability to recognize mold mycotoxins when we inhale them. So you breathe in mold, right? So you breathe it in, it comes in through the face and the nose. What should happen in an ideal genomic response pattern is your immune system says, hey, there it is, there's mold. It tags it. And then along come removal white blood cells that come along and phagocytize it, grab it, get rid of it. And you move it in through the liver, and the liver processes it and dumps it into the bile. And then our little gallbladder squeeze it out, and the bile duct squishes it out right into the small intestine, right? And then you poop it out, right? And so you get rid of it, right? And so 25% of the population is genetically susceptible to mold because the first step, which is see it, flag it, and tag it, doesn't happen. And what is
Okay.
such a crazy thing about the way mold can move into your body, like it can like work its way around the windowsill or in your shower or behind the wall where the leak is in the bathroom, right? Or whatever, right? What's so fascinating is mycotoxins, right? Think about mushrooms are obviously a great example. You know, if you step on a mushroom, it goes poof, right? It's almost like a dandelion. Right. And like millions of these little tiny spores get released that release mycotoxins. So you've got mold that's related to water damage and some kind of a moisture problem, which is like a little mold spore and mycotoxin factory. Or you have dried up old mold where the source of the water damage is now gone, but you're living in a space that has mycotoxins all over it. So mycotoxins are the little puffy, fluffy things that blow off a dandelion, right? And so the crazy thing about them is they settle in the dust. It's a dust transfer problem. And they're tiny and they're like part lipophilic and part hydrophilic, which means they're sticky, right? So they stick to stuff. They're hard to wipe off because you smear them all over the place if you don't know how to clean the dust, right? And in our bodies, they come in, we breathe them in, and with that little lipophilic component, it now has the ability to attach to the cell membrane and get into the cell and get into the mitochondria or circulate around in the bloodstream. So they
Oh.
can move through the body and they stay put and they don't go away. And so you're basically in that genetic susceptibility. You become basically a sponge for mycotoxins, right? And so many people with this mold-related disorder, biotoxin illness, so many of them will have headaches, sinus problems, runny noses, ear infections, sore throats, you know, because that's where the first hit, you know, is coming in. But what COVID interestingly did is kind of stunned this vagal nerve part of the story, and
Okay.
mold paralyzes, like in the sense, I say paralyze lightly, like it's not that you can't swallow, but it disengages the afferent signaling from the gut to the brain, which the gut-brain connection, that upward movement that's happening up that vagus nerve, is part of
Right.
what turns down the cell danger response. Right. And allows for us to turn down inflammation and take our bodies out of stress. So, if we don't have healthy vagal afferent communication, we stay like kind of tilted in this stress response, this sympathetically dominated state. Right. So, we have a really hard time going parasympathetic, which we need to swallow and digest and poop and breathe and sleep and just chill out, you know? So that's kind of the really remarkable thing is in somebody who had mold, they maybe didn't even know that they had a mold illness until they got hit with the spike protein, an infection, or potentially a vaccine trigger. And then all of a sudden, they could live in their home or they could be around things previous, but now all of a sudden, they're no longer tolerant of being in that same mold.
Just a question that came to mind as you were mentioning inflammation. So if somebody has relatively normal biomarkers, so we do some bloods and everything's okay, but C-reactive protein is high and nothing you do brings it down, even over a period of a year or two, could that possibly be an indicator that there's this kind of activity happening?
Absolutely, it could be at play, right? And we would also think about hidden infections, right? It would sort of send us down the stealth infection, stealth biotoxin world, right? Because, like, sometimes what gets revealed is maybe there is a previously undetected infection in a root canal, right? Or maybe there's a hidden deep infection somewhere. And so, yes, mold biotoxins, you would think of mycotoxin challenges, and you would be thinking about the vascular perfusion. And could this person be dealing with inflammation inside of their blood vessels that, yeah, they may not have hypertension, but they have exhaustion and brain fatigue, and they're cognitively challenged, and they're coughing, and they're going down this whole checklist where, for so many people, their labs even check out relatively normal or just mildly altered. Right? It's a clinical picture.
So let's just go back to when 2020, when we were all hit with COVID or the possibility of getting ill, the mind state, the anxiety, the panic, the the unknowing, coupled with this kind of spike protein. Let's go into the sort of the potential perfect storm that sense of helplessness and hopelessness will create in a body where you have this genetic potential for disaster. That's the only way of saying that. How important, I mean, let's look at where you were when you got ill. Yeah. I mean, we always look, you know, in what you taught me in functional medicine is we always ask the question, what happened 5 years ago? What happened, you know, a couple of years prior to the event? Because there's a lag period between when you really get sick and what happened a couple of years previous. So, you know, I always ask people who come to me with chronic pain or with whatever they're dealing with is what happened 5 to 10 years ago. And you see the lights turn on in the brain. They go, wow, this is what happened. So let's just chat about that for a bit, because I think it's really important and very interesting.
Yeah, I think people identify and become aware of their long hauling when they really do their timeline story, because the healthcare provider is going to find their long hauling piece in the story. Yeah. Right. And so when we go back, I basically, in my medical intake, I'm like, I want you to tell me about your life up until 2020. Yeah. And then I sort of stop and I shift gears and then I put on my post-pandemic hat and my medical detective hat and say, now I want to talk about your post-pandemic story. Because medicine changed forever at that point, like forever. Mm-hmm. How we take a medical history has changed forever. Like our thoughtfulness and what we need to be considering forever has been modified. So maybe somebody had an autoimmune disease, or like I said, a dormant tick-borne disease, or an old Epstein-Barr, or an old infection, right? Or type 2 diabetes or hypertension. There's no doubt that we have seen a large group of who was more susceptible to becoming long haulers. I think the hard part of the story is it was horrible. The first 18 months, right? The millions of people that we lost.
Yeah.
Right? When we look at and strike, what are the comorbidities, right? Obesity, diabetes, insulin resistance, hypertension. Like now it makes sense why those were the individuals who sadly didn't survive the first waves of meeting this particular infection, right? Because really, ultimately, it's a very strange cardiovascular traumatizing virus. Right. And we really haven't had anything that did that before. You know, how COVID comes into our body and takes over shop and ultimately can eliminate the host, it's genius. Yeah. Right. If you wanted to hurt somebody, maim somebody, take them out, like the mechanisms of what this bug does to us is sort of genius if you're coming at it from the level of I'm going to destroy the host. Right. So when we look back, there's sort of this list of pre-infections, metabolic complications, body composition, athleticism, nutrition status, and genomics that matters. Yeah. Right. And then after that window of time, this is where we now have this sort of second epidemic, and it's the walking wounded. Right. It's individuals who kind of had this sort of gap. They're like, oh, I'm healthy. I eat great. I don't have much to worry about. I take my zinc, my essential fatty acids. I've been always taking my immune modulators. I got nothing to worry about. Right. And then what we saw is this huge swath of those who did all the right things. Yeah. Are all of a sudden not understanding why they can't think clear, why they can't get through the day, why they're forgetting, why they're literally dropping some of the most important things that they have going on in their life, right? And so this secondary wave, the thing that really got me was looking at some of the data that says it doesn't matter whether or not your trigger was getting infected or getting vaccinated.
Ah.
It didn't matter what your source was. Yeah. People are still long haul. So we can't just like blame it on a vaccine. No. We can't just push the blame and say, well, it's only those people that are long hauling. There's plenty of people that did not ever get vaccinated and they're long hauling. Right. And then there's others who did get vaccinated and it's very clear, like that was the exposure time and bang, here comes their long haul related symptoms. So I feel like, yes, there's plenty of people in the world who are going to go work on that story and tease apart the data, and that's not my purpose in the world. My purpose in the world is helping long haulers get well, like just like period, right? That there's so much politics tied around the back end of all
Oh,
this. It doesn't really help me be a better doctor or
no,
diagnostician.
and it's not going to solve a problem.
It's not going to solve it now. And we as healthcare providers, like we took the oath, really. We took the oath to be there to help our patients, right? There's plenty of wonderful people in the world trying to help solve the story and how did this happen, right? But what we also know is there's people who got exposed who didn't even know that they were carrying COVID. They didn't even realize that they had it because they weren't expressing symptoms, and they too are long hauling, right? And so things that I found fascinating is the oral microbiome, the gut microbiome, alterations in some of our bug state in our body, like that could have been what set somebody up to become a long hauler. Right? Someone with an old history of an autoimmune disease that was now in remission, that was non-active, that could have set somebody up to become a long hauler. You could have complications with glutathione and multiple different single nucleotide polymorphisms that make it harder for your body's antioxidants and your mitochondria and your inflammatory response patterns to happen. That could have set you up for long hauling, right? And then that whole co-infection and previous stealth infection piece is just huge in this story. So it's the story.
So how do we it that is the story. So how do we help people get well? Where do we start? Because there's bound to be people going, well, this is me. Where do we start fixing this?
One, I think there has to be a lot of self-compassion. Like, I think it starts, like, honestly, like turning in, because all of us ask the question over and over again, what is wrong with me? What happened? Am I ever going to get better? And like feeling that level of hopelessness and like, seriously, how did I get here? Like, it really can mess with your mental, emotional status and your mindset, right? So, one, no, you're not alone. And two, like, get rid of the shame and the blame for being a long hauler. Like, we need to just give people permission to lean in and honestly, with transparency and authenticity, say, you know what? I'm not quite right. And that doesn't mean you being a healthy lifestyler before didn't work. Like, that's, I think, such a huge hangup because a lot of people don't even want to admit that they're having these symptoms. Right. So I think,
I'm one of those. If I
right?
have any symptoms, I'm like, well, I can't admit to that. Yeah, we
I
can't go
was
there.
totally one of those until like I couldn't do the six digits, right? And I couldn't do the lift anymore. And I couldn't make it to the gym every, like, I was like, are you kidding me? Like, these are objectable, like these are objective measurements now. They're not just my subjective opinion of myself, but these are like objective activities that I can't do, right? So like recognize it. So number one, be totally real with yourself and say, okay, like, is this going on for me? Right. And then I think two is I have every one of my patients really go back and reflect on their story because they need to understand their story and be real around the fact that, yeah, this has been sequentially building over some time. And part of how we get well is understanding how do we get here. Right. So that I think is important. So there's some foundational nutrition. You know me, I'm food first. I love food. I love everything about nourishment and nutrition. So I think from a food first perspective, anti-inflammatory diets help. They don't solve the whole problem, but they help, right? So either get on a standard anti-inflammatory diet or what I do is I run a lab, a company called KBMO. I like their FIT176 test because it's testing for food-induced inflammation. And that's what I want to know. I want to know, like, which foods does this patient eat that trigger inflammation response in their body? Because I want them out. I want them, like, out of their diet. Two, I want to know,
And it could be anything.
it could be anything. It blows my mind. You know what just makes me so frustrated is when the test results come back and it's turmeric and CBD and olive oil or coconut oil or cinnamon or like things that are like the tools in my toolbox that I always have known the data around is anti-inflammatory. But not for that patient,
Very frustrating.
right? Not for that patient. That's not the right formula or the right approach, right? So I like that. It's kind of like foundation 101. So I want to know about food nutrition. I want to test vitamin D levels and I want to test essential fatty acid levels. because that way we can dial in and get the right levels of D in place, and we can get the right understanding of arachidonic acid levels to EPA. I want to know that omega-3 to arachidonic acid level, and I want to know, are we depleted in EPA, DHA? Like, where do we need to go to sort of tip the scale and get the oils and fats right in the diet? Right. And I need to know, like, do they have a cod reaction? Do they have a salmon reaction? Do they have a squid calamari reaction? Because then that forces me as the practitioner to step back and say, okay, what's the right fish or fish oil for you? Right. I'm going to put a fish oil in every plan if I can. And 95%, maybe 98% of the time, I can. Right. So one, vitamin D. Two, zinc. Right. Three, essential fatty acids. And if I can go back to zinc, what I thought was wild is, you know, Dr. Michael Stone, right? For years, he's been championing the understanding of the nutrition physical exam, right? Like 10 years ago, he's teaching physicians that if you have a zinc deficiency, you may lose your sense of taste and smell, right? And that that is a very important physical exam finding that's identified 7 years before the onset of cognitive decline and dementia. Right. So zinc, right? Super interesting, right? So now all of a sudden it's headline news, right? Zinc may help patients with COVID in long haul. You bet it can.
Oh my God.
Right. It's like now it's common knowledge. Like it was on the news, it was on the top of right newspapers. So how cool is that that people learned? Now, why? Well,
Finally.
right. Finally, right. It's coming into real life. So what's so interesting about zinc is it's one of the most important, you can sort of simply summarize and say it's like a birth control for viruses, right? If you've got a viral installed in the body, zinc is part of your team of resources that can slow down viral replication and can help your body conquer, tackle, and kind of shut that virus down from moving cell to cell and taking over its host. So if you've got that protection on board, your zinc volume, your zinc load that you have, your body naturally is going to gobble it up, use it up as a part of its natural defense mechanism. And if you deplete your zinc levels so far that they become depleted, that you can't smell and you can't taste, it's like this big red meter say, wow, your body's working really, really hard to fight this off. Right. So obviously, right, zinc, most every nutritionist is like, wow, okay, like look at this powerful association and connection to what we've known about zinc, right, for a couple decades. Right. So, kind of summarizing, D, zinc, essential fatty acids, they're like nutrition 101, you know, in what we're doing. I didn't tend to myself use a lot of vitamin A. And I do it in bursts, big 3 to 5 day hit of vitamin A. We don't typically give high doses of vitamin A, but in this case, we do because of its antiviral nature. And then we drop it way back down to more of a maintenance level if we keep vitamin A going on at all. Another important foundational piece is going to be looking at your probiotic status, prebiotics, probiotics. Right, because that gut microbiome serves such a powerful role. So, spore probiotics, those phages play a valuable role. So, it's getting a really good variety of rotating your probiotics and all those amazing prebiotics that will feed those gut bugs. Yeah, pour it down the chute. You know? I tend to have every single long hauler do an evening drink where they're using a pre and probiotic before bed, just so we can keep reseeding and kind of feeding that gut while they're sleeping at night. So, like, that's the basics, right? Then, if somebody does convert in, they have the infection or they're long hauling. There's some amazing botanicals, you know, that can be used. So there's different formulations that can come together that do have strong antiviral nature and characteristics. But for me, one of the most powerful things that I use in my toolbox is going after the healing response on the inside of the blood vessels. Right. So the lining of the inside of those blood vessels, this is kind of cool. Like we didn't ever, like most physicians never learned this in medical school. And so if you take like a cross section of the tube of the blood vessel inside of it, like, do you remember back before we knew there was a microbiome, right? Like this is such a big deal, right? Like,
We've been doing
right?
that
Like going back,
long.
right? And we didn't understand the mechanisms of leaky gut, right? Don't forget to remind me to come back to mold and leaky gut before we wrap, okay? Because that's kind of
Okay, let's do
fascinating.
that.
Right. So we've got leaky gut, leaky brain, and leaky vessels is now what we've learned. right? And so damage and
Yeah.
inflammation will happen to the inside of the lining of the blood vessels. So what the inside of our blood vessels and capillaries are lined with is this coating. It's almost like this slippery slime. It's like little tiny seaweeds or little noodles kind of hanging out on the whole lining inside
Yeah.
of the vessels. And when you take a cross section of it, that inside lining or coating is called the endothelial glycocalyx. Okay. It's like this slimy mucilaginous, they're proteolytic, they're proteoglycans. And so there are these interesting little hairs, and you can see them on microscopic electron microscopy evaluation. You can see them now, which is so amazing. It's like
Yeah.
Teflon, right? Not that we endorse Teflon, right, in our world, but it's like a Teflon, right? And so as you've got the red blood cells moving through the vessel, you've got your white blood cells tumbling along, you've got all of your components inside of the blood, they're moving through with flow dynamic, right? And as long as that little seaweed, right, and as long as that little coating is there, things move through without eddying back or causing disruption in the flow dynamic. And the COVID virus is one of multiple things that will damage the lining of the endothelium. Right now, we didn't even know we were talking about this in cardiovascular disease before, when we would say diet and exercise and smoking, and like kind of this whole list of what were the risk factors for heart disease and atherosclerosis and damaged vasculature. What happens first in damage to the whole cardiovascular cascade is a breakdown of the lining of the Teflon, the endothelial glycocalyx. And in the endothelial glycocalyx,
So do you,
oh, yeah.
sorry, just I don't want to lose the train of thought, just interrupt you. You remember during COVID there were these, I don't know, autopsies, or there were these images of doctors pulling out these gloopy clots from, is this what was going on?
Yes, this is a
Right.
part of the cascade, right? So fascinatingly, in the blood vessels, you've got damage to the lining of that vasculature, and we see that the spike protein triggered tiny microclots as the body's natural response to the damage, right? Because the body's doing its best to heal the problem. So it's like, well, maybe if we clot, that will help with the leaky vessel problem, right? And so, yes, like, and so many, like, nurses too, like trying to, draw blood or even try to run IVs, and they're like pulling out these stringy, goopy clots, right? So, yeah, that's a part of the story. So, not something that people talk about. And honestly, in the United States, it has been something that we've been instructed not to talk about. Practitioners haven't been allowed to really openly even say the words long haul COVID. You're not encouraged in any way to say you're treating COVID patients, right? And so that's kind of a whole nother story. But
Crazy.
what I think is fascinating is the lungs, that the chest films of the long haulers, right? You take an X-ray and you look at those long haulers' chest, and they have a very interesting speckled pattern. It's called shard glass, right? And that's little tiny microclots all over in the vasculature in the pulmonary tissue, right? And we're coughing and
Oh my
coughing
God.
because we're trying to improve the oxygen exchange at that level. And here we can see it objectively measured in our imaging assessments. So yeah, the secret sauce for me is the lining of the vessels. And there's been some great data that's come out, and there's some tools that had been recognized previously that were more a part of the hypertension story. Right, they were much more a part of the leaky brain and brain performance and cardiovascular disease, that have this fascinating sort of crossover where we recognize some of the applications that we can use for healing and recovery come through strategies we would have previously used for some of these hypertension patients. So, rhamnose sulfate, interesting seaweed. Rhamnose sulfate comes it's kind of an interesting isolate that comes from this seaweed, this brown seaweed that's called Monostromum nitidum. And so it's a particular kind of seaweed. And if you kind of think about seaweed, it's kind of slippery and slimy and mucilaginous nature. I love that about botanical medicine, because many of the traditional,
It
right,
mirrors.
like the signatures, right, like the amazing capability of sort of seeing the way the food acts, the way it heals, has got the interesting doctrine of signature, we call it, right, in botanical medicine. I think that's
It
kind of
does,
cool
yes.
about it. So rhamnose sulfate is an extract that gets dehydrated, ground up, and put into a formulation, and that's one of the key things that I use, and that's kind of been like the secret sauce in me helping getting patients sort of over the hump. So anti-inflammatories, treating the endothelial glycocalyx, foundational nutrition. That is like the basics of where we start. As we start to ramp things up, we get more personalized, then we dig deeper into mitochondrial recovery work. We use mitochondrial nutrients, things like CoQ10, kind of our variables that will help produce higher levels of ATP. And then I got to really draw on, it's usually the devices that we can use and the techniques we can use to kickstart that sort of underperforming vagus nerve that tends to play such an important role. Humming, enemas, there's all kinds of pretty cool free things that you can do. Sometimes that's not enough. And so there are devices like frequency-specific microcurrent that I have found really was the only thing that got my vagus nerve firing after all those years. So there are some pretty cool tools in the toolbox that can help us kickstart vagal recovery. And so first of all, you got to step back and say, well, which symptoms do I have? Right? Because the symptoms that you have help sort of guide you in that direction of where do I need to go next?
And it is so complex, when, especially if it's you and you're a practitioner. This is your field, and when it happens to you, it can almost blindside you. It's all virtually impossible to treat yourself,
And you're
and
not
this is the
thinking clear,
frustration.
right? And you're having brain fog, right? So like things in your head, but you can't find it. And some of that executive functioning isn't quite right. And like decision trees you used to run in your brain and kind of whip down and get to the answer, like you get stuck in the decision tree and you're like, okay, I can't figure this out.
It is so debilitating. So let's swing back to mold and leaky gut. You wanted to go there.
Like that was a big aha for me. Cause I've been like teaching leaky gut, treating leaky gut for like my whole career, right? As long as I can think back. And one of the big ahas for me were the patients who are doing all the right things. They're taking the right things. They've weeded out and they have dealt with infection or candida or biotoxin coming from lipopolysaccharides and bad bugs hanging out in your gut, right? And you've done the restoration nutrition, which basically, boils down to glutamine, deglycerinated licorice, and aloe, right? Those are like magic for healing a permeability problem, right? So if you've kind of done all those things, and then they like keep retesting that they have permeability problem, right? They still have a leaky gut. What I had never been taught or connected the dots on is every time you eat good fats or bad fats, when you're eating fats, right, your bile is going to come dripping out or squeezing out. Whether you have a gallbladder or not, you're going to be effluxing bile, right? So if you don't have a gallbladder anymore, that's a huge red flag to me now around mold, right? Because that means you got sludgy, toxic mold, mycotoxin bile, right? So part of how you treat mold is you do lipotropics. You use some of the formulations that help thin the bile and help the bile ease out. And how do you help move bile out of the body and mold out of the body is you take fish oil, you take lipotropic factors, and you improve the efflux, and then you bind and you poop out that bile, and out goes some of those mycotoxins, right? It's low and slow, but it's an imperative part of mold. Well, many of our patients who just keep circling the drain around and around and around again with their leaky gut and their food reactions and their food sensitivities and their permeability problem comes back to the fact that they're draining mycotoxins in their bile. They got mold.
And we see
They have
so
mold. And
much
if
with people with gallbladder surgery, if had their gallbladders removed. Oh my God, it is so challenging to get that right.
right?
The other question I
Yeah,
have,
so little
carry
clinical
on, carry on. I'll go back to
pearl,
my other
kind of a
question.
big aha. Yeah.
So what are your thoughts? Okay, I'm going to frame this for you. Couple of years ago, about 3 years ago, I started seeing clients coming in who with gut issues specifically. So Crohn's disease, IBS, all sorts and kinds of gut issues. So we've all got a gut protocol. We use the licorice, we use the aloe, and they do work, and then they stop working. And we use the bone broth and all the usual protocols just stop working. So one day I, out of pure desperation, suggested to this client that she try a carnivore protocol. And this poor woman was so desperate that she, I mean, she's in her 80s, and this is not somebody who eats red meat out of choice, but she was so desperate, and she had been through such emotional turmoil. She should try anything. Well, it was miraculous. Needless to say, it was absolutely miraculous. It took about 6 months of strict carnivore, and it was a strict carnivore. It was organ meats, and it was all grass-fed fats and red meat. And I'd say she's still fine, even though we've transitioned off it. Then I've tried this protocol with a number of people with autoimmune disease, with really chronic problems where there's inflammation or autoimmune or severe gut issues, and we've tested it. And without fail, 100% of the time, I'd say there's about 35 people so far who've had the most incredible results. Now, maybe it's because red meat, good quality red meat, doesn't cause inflammation or doesn't trigger inflammations like other foods might. What are your thoughts about that protocol? And do you think it's, I don't think it's sustainable, just from a boredom point of view, not from a health point of view. People eating red meat seem to do so well for such a long period of time. It's because you taught us to eat rainbows, and it was almost like,
I know.
ah, well, how can I
I
ethically do
know. It's
this?
painful, right?
Just a quick mention before we continue. The Jackson's Real Food Market and Reinvent Masterclass is back in March and April. Join Gary and I for our ever popular workshop that covers exactly why you're battling to lose weight, manage gut issues, and stay committed to your health goals. See the link in the show notes to find out how to book. I promise it will change your life forever.
I totally love Shin. So I would say what I have come to appreciate is that if someone is going through this level of immune-induced challenge with challenge, especially with mold, hands down, if they're moldy and they don't even know it, part of the problem is oxalates. And when we look at oxalates in the foods, right, the carnivore diet is the perfect counter to somebody who is reactive or struggling with oxalates, right? Because oxalates are our favorite foods in the antioxidant story, right? I mean, it's everything from the chocolate to our favorite greens to almonds to, I mean, you just go down the checklist and I look at the oxalate list and I'm like, these are some of our highest, what we would celebrate as our highest phytonutrient-rich antioxidant foods. But they've got oxalates. And there's a substantial current movement happening, I would say, right now in sort of understanding the mold story. So I can definitely say most of those patients often had mold and we didn't know it. And that's why they're responding so well. I mean, there's patients who have oxalates coming out of their skin, right? It's so debilitating. And the solution is to get off, which is crazy to say, get off all fruits and vegetables,
Oh,
get off nuts and seeds. And
crazy.
the carnivore diet, right, saves them. It literally saves them. So I see that it's phasic in their healing plan. It's used for a while. It could be 3 months, 6 months. I don't love to see it longer than a 6 month
Agree.
window. There's certain patients, right, that respond really well and it gets them off the carbohydrates, the grains, the nuts, the seeds, and the triggers that are invoking and causing their own level of inflammation, right? So it's odd to say it becomes the carnivore diet for some patients under some circumstances, it becomes anti-inflammatory, right? Which is almost counterintuitive, right, to what we think of with the balance of arachidonic acid. So I think the way to survive being on a carnivore diet is you got to have plenty of fish oil. You got to understand whether or not you may have mold. That might have been the problem in the first place, and you're healing the mold toxicity, and therefore the symptoms are starting to kind of find their way back around again. So I think it's a brilliant question. It's my same discovery, and I always find it intriguing when patients are like, "What do you think? Can I try it?" I never say no anymore. I think maybe 5 to 10 years ago, I would have been like, "Cringe! Like, how are we going to get your phytonutrient?" Right? But now, what I have come to appreciate and embrace, Sally Norton's work is amazing. You know, in that whole toxic superfood story of oxalates, I think there is a place. There's a time and a place for it, and a patient that responds well, in my brain, it's potentially mold until proven otherwise.
Yeah, that makes all kinds of sense. And it really is the only protocol that I've found that really and truly heals leaky gut like nothing else. especially if you can endure it for 3 to 4 months.
Yeah. So testing for mold, right? It's a urine test. And so one of the kind of standards over here, at least, is a lab called RealTime. That tends to be the go-to gold standard preferred test by most practitioners over here. So you do a glutathione challenge for a patient a week before you collect the urine sample because you want to be mobilizing stored mycotoxins out of the body, right? Especially if they fall into that 24% where it may be sequestered, you know, over time. So you do a glutathione challenge for a week, and I always want to know, how did you feel on the glutathione? Some people feel great and they feel better. Some people feel worse. Some people feel nothing. Right. And then you get seventh night, and then you have them take either a sauna or a hot steamy shower. And then they get up in the morning and they immediately catch their urine. And so the whole point of doing that is sort of standardize a routine so that you can catch the urine sample. Because yeah, if somebody doesn't have the genes, you're going to have a hard time getting the mycotoxins out of the body and in the urine. Right. And so, yeah, it is not a perfect test, but what you're looking for is what kinds of mycotoxins do we catch? I wouldn't interpret it at the level of that we got the exact volume or amount or that it represents the storage amount, but I want to know what is in there and what is not in there.
Now,
first
sense.
Of all, and then you go back 6 months, 12 months later, and you recatch to test. It's not uncommon for their mold mycotoxin level to go up in that second urine sample because they're finally eliminating and removing the mold that was sequestered. So on average, it's usually like 9 to 18 months for most people going through a mold treatment protocol and care plan, but it can absolutely be done.
So Christy, what message do you have for those who are struggling to get the right diagnosis or treatment, knowing full well that they've tried everything, they're just feeling terrible and they know something's going on?
Take the time to get out a big piece of paper and take your time and do your own timeline history and say, what was going on for me before 2020? And then really break down the sequence of events before we get too far out and you kind of start to forget, right? When did I get exposed? What would have happened? How did I feel? Go back and use pictures, right? Look in your phone, scroll your pictures, or go back to your social media and look at yourself. Right? And like use any of these triggers to say, oh, I remember where I was on June 26th in 2022. It was my 50th birthday and that fourth COVID infection. I've never been well since. Right. So like use these little mile markers and trigger your memory. Cause if you got brain fog, you're not going to lay it out sequentially. So like get a big old whiteboard going and do your timeline and say, okay, can I remember when I had energy? And then when did I not have energy? Think about things like, you know, your favorite things to do. When did you lose creativity? When did you stop playing the guitar or crocheting or doing art? Like, when did you stop doing things that you love that were creative and passionate? Because all of those are ways for us to identify our own story and what's been happening over time. So I'd say the place to start is reflection. Give yourself permission. Take a month even. And then you might be like at the grocery store and you're like, oh, I remember when I had that head trauma. Do you remember when I had that concussion and I fell and bonked my head? Right? Because head trauma. Can activate many of the challenges or complications related to long hauling. Right. So do your story, do your history, be honest with yourself, throw out the shame and the blame, woulda, coulda, shoulda. There's no room for that in healing. There's just no room for that for healing journey at this point. So like get rid of the politics, get rid of your preconceived thoughts or your rate limiting mindset around what it means to be long hauling. You live on this planet. There is no way you haven't been exposed to a variant of this COVID virus at some point. Just because you didn't get sick doesn't mean you are not long hauling.
And I think it's also important to find a practitioner who also won't, you know, make you feel like you're being judged and talking nonsense. Because there's unfortunately many doctors out there who will look at you strangely and try and offer you an antidepressant if you talk about long hauling. Unfortunately, but there are many, many practitioners and out there who will take you seriously. So it is, it's always about finding that partnership.
Ask questions, never stop asking questions, right? Good questions lead to more questions.
I love that. That is exactly it. That's what it always comes down to. So Christy, if anyone wants to get hold of you, find out about, you know, how to work with you, the tests that you offer, where can they get hold of you?
I'm all over social media. LinkedIn is probably a great spot to find me, track us down. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram. I definitely take new patients. I do everything telemedicine and Zoom.
Brilliant.
My preference is that I will consult and support individuals, and I want them to have a boots on the ground GP primary care behind the scenes. So, I help guide and support a lot of individuals on their journey.
Yeah.
I don't need to be your doctor, but I sure can help be your guide.
Yeah.
And that's really my favorite role, is to be a part of a collaborating care team
Love it.
where we put that patient in the center and we're all there helping them get the answers and the tools that they need to get well.
Brilliant, brilliant. Thank you so much. And it is so good to see you and connect again after all this time.
Thank you. It's been quite a journey.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with friends and family. And please don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss an episode.